Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Due to the somewhat remarkable success of the treatment for HIV and AIDS, efforts for HIV infections to be controlled are increasingly improved. No longer do we have to worry about AIDS being a virtual death sentence. Efforts are now being invigorated and changed to really try to prevent infection. Knowing if you are infected allows for an effective use of treatment that is now present to prevent spread to other individuals. June 27th is designated as the National HIV Testing Day, and it's in one reason is it's an important date is it encourages everyone to learn that what their HIV status is. Today, in addition to helping listeners perhaps understand HIV and AIDS a little bit better, we're going to be talking about how HIV transmission to others can be dramatically decreased. Our guests are Rebecca Morrissey. She is the HIV Prevention Coordinator with the Alaskan AIDS Assistance Association, and that association's executive director is Heather Davis. Heather has been on the program a number of times. We've kind of gotten to the point where Line One would like to do everything we can to help control this problem. So we're doing this on a fairly yearly basis to bring everybody up to date where we are with this infection and disease. Also, we're hoping that Terry Brammel, who is the program director of the AIDS program at Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, will be able to reach us and join us by telephone. She's out of town, and we're trying to get in touch. We've just not been able to make that connection yet, but throughout the program, hopefully she'll be able to help us with some of the medical issues. For those of you who are listening, you can join us with your questions and comments. If you're in Anchorage, you can call us directly at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Let me give you that one again, line1@alaskapublic.org, and you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line one. So, Rebecca, welcome.
Hello.
Nice to have you here. I think this is your first time.
It is. It's good to be here.
And Heather, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having us again.
Let's hope we can get a hold of Terry. So let's start. My traditional way is when we have organizations on is to learn a little bit about the organization. So tell us about the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association.
Sure. The Alaska AIDS Assistance Association has been around for over 30 years now. We started this organization early in the epidemic to address the needs of people who are being diagnosed with HIV and AIDS and assist them in getting services that they needed and hooking them up to medical care and medications. We still provide that service. We have about 287 active clients that we serve here and around the state. Living with HIV and AIDS, get them connected to housing and food and nutrition and medical care and medications, whatever they need. The other thing we do is provide HIV prevention services, which is our education and outreach. We do free HIV testing and hepatitis C testing for people. And then we also run a syringe access program here in Anchorage and also in our Juneau office to provide clean syringes in the works for people who are dealing with drug addiction.
Good, good. Terry, I understand we have you on the line.
You do.
Welcome. Nice to have you
Thank
back.
You.
So tell us the efforts that you're making, what's going on at the Tribal Health Consortium with regards to HIV and AIDS at this point.
Okay, well, we have a clinical program called the Ryan White Part C program where we see HIV-positive patients at Alaska Native Medical Center in the Internal Medicine Clinic. Those are tribal beneficiaries. We also travel to Bethel and Dillingham and Fairbanks and do satellite clinics. And then we also have a prevention program through the state of Alaska, focusing mostly on prevention with positive people and their partners. And we're also part of the Mountain West AIDS Education and Training Center. So we're on faculty there, and we do provider education around the state.
I have already commented before you probably joined us by telephone is that the treatment of HIV and AIDS has really dramatically changed the face of the illness in that it is now kind of a lifelong kind of chronic disease where people can live fairly normal existence. I don't want to oversell or misstate, but is that generally true?
That's generally true, that people now, if they're on medications and following medical advice, taking care of themselves, can lead a near normal lifespan.
But we still don't have a vaccine, and so the ability to prevent infection is where we are working, is kind of my introduction.
Yes, we have a number of tools in the toolbox. The newest one is pre-exposure prophylaxis, where a negative high-risk person can take a medication to prevent acquiring the virus, along with condoms and behavior change and syringe exchange and the IV drug use group, that we have clean needles for people.
Right. We want to definitely talk about the preventative efforts in a large way here today. But before we do that, I'm going to ask each of you or one of you guys to comment on the importance of national HIV testing day, given that background. What's the main reasons for this, making this a national day?
Well, because one of the big issues is that a lot of people don't know whether they're HIV positive or not. 1 in 8 people in the United States do not know that they have HIV. And so the importance of testing day is to make sure people get out and get tested. The CDC recommendation is everybody from age 13 to 64 should get a test at least once in their life. And then depending on their sexual practices or behaviors, get them more often than that is needed. But the big issue is getting people tested, because we know the sooner you test and the sooner you get a medication, then the longer life you can live. And also when people are on medication, they can get their viral load to an undetectable status, hopefully, which also helps prevent the transmission of the disease.
Has anyone been able to figure out if of those people that are infected and don't know how? You said it's 1 in 8. So does that mean that 1 in 8 people who are infected don't know? And so 7
Correct.
Out of 8 know. So most people know they're infected, but only a small percentage don't.
12.8%, they say, in the United States are unaware of their infection.
Is there some thoughts about the primary reason they don't know? I mean, obviously, we've talked about in the past that this illness, there's a long period from infection to symptoms sometimes, at least significant symptoms. Is that part of the problem?
It is. This is Rebecca. So from the time that somebody gets infected up to about 3 months, we call that the window period, where somebody can be HIV positive but not show up on a test. Unfortunately, during that time period is when somebody is most infectious and most at risk to pass the virus on to somebody else. We know that about 50% of infections happen with somebody either who is infected and doesn't know they are infected, or somebody who is infected and is not in treatment.
All right. So the most contagious period is once you've been infected, but you're least likely at that time to know you're infected.
Exactly.
And so the transmission during that period of time can be devastating. And I think what's the percentage of people who are infected who do some risky behavior? I guess it depends on the behavior, what percentage of people. But a significant number of people will get the illness transmitted to them, particularly through certain sexual activities, let's say.
Right. And we know that early stage infection symptoms that somebody may present with, they may not know that it's related to previous sexual activity or other behaviors that are associated with contracting HIV. For example, someone may have a fever and body ache, so it can look significantly like the flu, which they may not associate with sex that they had 2 to 3 weeks prior.
So who's at greatest risk then of acquiring, and who's at greatest risk of transmitting? Can we help people understand that?
So there are people who are more at risk, as CDC defined high risk. So Centers for Disease Control has identified specific groups of people that are more at risk for contracting and spreading HIV. Nationwide, we continue to see that men who have sex with men is our highest group at risk for contracting and spreading HIV. There's a grouping called high-risk heterosexuals, and those are individuals who may have a partner who is using IV drugs, may have a partner who, a female in particular, who may have a partner who is having sex with other men. And then having a partner is called serodiscordancy, where somebody is HIV positive and someone is HIV negative, but they're in a long-term relationship to one another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The needle stick exposure issue is, I'm guessing, is maybe an area where there's a lot of increased effort because of some of the issues around needle sharing activities and how well that's accepted by the general population.
So are you talking about a needle stick by a physician or injection drug use?
No, I'm sorry. Needle use, I'm sorry.
Yeah, injection drug use.
That there's arguments to me, the evidence is very good that providing needles to individuals who have an addiction problem is very, very cost-effective and useful in preventing it.
It is.
But it seems to me that the general population may still wonder why that policy exists.
Sure. So 4A's practices something called harm reduction, which is the concept that there's a behavior that exists and we can lessen the impact of that specific behavior. So when we think somebody coming in using IV drugs, we see it as it's better to prevent bloodborne illness and the associated long-term chronic illnesses that somebody can acquire during their active drug using. In an effort to prevent those lifelong chronic illnesses
that are much costlier. I mean, it behooves us to prevent the illness in the first place.
Right.
And we do know that syringe exchanges work at decreasing the risk of infectious diseases, whether it's HIV, hepatitis C, or anything like that.
Right. So the costs and consequences of not having the program are clearly much more costly and dangerous to the population.
And it's also a chance for us to educate that population. When we're seeing that population regularly in our office, it gives us a chance to educate them, to refer them to sources. They're often don't want to be engaged with the medical community for obvious reasons. And so we're kind of a go-between and somebody that they learn to trust. And so we become that liaison and really help them wherever they are in their addiction process.
Heather, you've been involved with the 4A's for a while now. Do you think this effort is being successful and why? I should have been clear. The effort at helping control the spread of HIV. You've seen the success of treatment. Now we're working on preventing spread.
It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to pinpoint what works and what doesn't work because, we have no studies of that. And we see the numbers go up and down. This year we're seeing an increase again in the number of people that were diagnosing positive for HIV. Last year, the year before, it dropped dramatically. I think one of the things that still is just, HIV and AIDS isn't on the front page unless there is a big outbreak somewhere or something. So most people, it's not out there. It's not in front of people. We hear from the young population that wasn't alive when this epidemic started that it's no big deal. I can take a pill and really don't understand the full implications of this disease and what it means for lifelong health and how they manage their life moving forward.
All right, Terry, so let's try to understand this disease a little bit more before we get into this prevention. I always like to get to the fundamentals. Tell us a little bit about viral illnesses and then what's different about HIV as an illness compared to, let's say, the common cold, which is a virus, or mononucleosis, which is a cold virus.
Well, many viruses we don't have a cure for, but our immune system can help clear the virus on its own. But unfortunately, with HIV, the virus attacks the immune system so that it does not work as well, and it actually uses the immune system as a factory to make more HIV, and so it kind of chops off the army at the head. Mm-hmm. So the general can't direct the troops to fight off illness.
So it attacks some of the white blood cells that are so important to our ability to maintain safety against other viruses. And then there's a long quiet period while that where that's going on until those immune system is really no longer able to do its job. And that's what the AIDS part of HIV/AIDS is all about. Now you have an acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, AIDS, as a result of this prolonged infection.
Right. On the average, it takes around 10 years for untreated HIV to develop to the point of AIDS in a person.
So,
with medication, we try to arrest that as soon as possible.
So if I was a young person who may be having heterosexual sex and thinking, well, gosh, all I have to do is, well, maybe I'll wear a condom, and maybe even if I get infected, I'll just have to take some medication for the rest of my life. What's your answer to that?
Well, prevention. it's not so simple as just taking a pill a day. There's a lot of issues around that in terms of expense and time and lab work and the medicine not being 100% effective.
Yeah, there's complications of the medications. I mean, and then you also got this period of time when you may not even know you're infected, and you're going around and potentially infecting other individuals. And
right.
And human, the nature has a way of figuring out a way around problems. So it's quite likely that HIV virus will figure out a way to become less responsive to the current treatments, and we're going to constantly have to keep upgrading that armamentarium, and we may or may not be successful in the future. Is that fair to say as well?
Right. We have had major issues in the past with the virus being resistant to all the medications we have, and we have some newer medications over the last 3 or 4 years that are quite potent. And so far, you know, we're doing well with them, but they still have the potential that the virus can develop resistance to them, and then we're in trouble again. So there's a lot of ongoing research developing new medications.
And as we know,
one of the new medications they're trying to develop is an injectable, because what we find is sort of that small group of people that we cannot get taking medications successfully because of all their life challenges, be it substance abuse or developmental delays or mental illness, that we could actually, at some point, we're going to have some injectable medications that could be given once a month, and that will go a long way for that last group of people that are very hard to treat.
Because that's one of the difficulties is medication adherence. I mean, we see it often in our clients that, like Terry said, who are battling other things like homelessness. And you know, we know that if they get on their medications and go off and then go on, it just, you know, causes that resistance to happen quicker. And just for anyone, you know, many people just to do a 7 to 10 day, you know, antibiotic treatment is hard. So when people say, oh, it's just a pill
right.
a day, they need to
right.
think of that, you know, mm-hmm. this is the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. So it is reasonable to say that the young adult population, this particularly heterosexual population who may not be aware that their male partners are having risky behavior with, particularly with other males, that increases their risk significantly.
Yeah, that's one of the issues with testing is there's a lot of people who don't have any perceived risk who have actually acquired the HIV, and they may not know everything their partner has ever done.
Right.
That puts them at risk, even if their behavior is not particularly risky. They're subject to whatever their partner's lifetime behaviors have been. And so people still have this perception that this is a gay male disease, and that if they're not a gay male, they're not at risk, and
mm-hmm.
that's not at all true.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind
the highest risk group.
Let me remind listeners again that what the topic today is HIV/AIDS, and particularly we're going to get into the importance of prevention as a way to control this particular problem. If you've got questions or comments, there's three ways you can get in touch with us to ask your question or make your comments online. You can call us directly at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-8433. 5752, and our email address is line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. You have to put that all together and spell it out, line1@alaskapublic.org. So we've already assumed somewhat that everybody realizes that exposure to blood and blood products is primarily, or should we say almost entirely, the way this virus is transmitted from person to person. Is that correct?
Not necessarily blood products, but body fluids,
okay.
Genital fluids, semen, mm-hmm. and blood.
All right, so like the recent Zika virus we've heard so much about, it may be also true that HIV is in semen or in cervical fluid, vaginal fluids?
That's correct.
All right. So it doesn't have to require blood exposure necessarily to be transmitted. What about... there's a small group of people involved, like yourselves, who are dealing with people that are infected. What's the risk of transmission now from individuals in the healthcare profession?
Well, if we have somebody successfully treated, meaning they're taking their medications daily, and their virus is either very low or undetectable, where we can't measure it, their risk of transmitting the virus to their partner is very, very, very small. We know it's at least a 96% reduction in risk, and it's really approaches 100% if that virus is not detected.
What about?
So it's really the biggest prevention tool that we have is getting people who have HIV into care and getting them suppressed.
And being suppressed means being consistent about taking medications.
Right, and also follow-up medical care, like lab work. That's the only way we know, by looking at the blood, how well the medicines are working against the virus.
So someone who's being treated is periodically tested to see how effective the treatment is or how consistent they are about taking their medications, and you can do that by seeing the level of the virus in the bloodstream.
Correct.
Let me ask one more question before we get into this prevention a little bit more, and that it has to do with what do we know about what we call the epidemiology in Alaska and the U.S. and so forth. Who's got it? Who's infected? We've talked about it a little bit. What age groups are affected the most? Let's put a face on who we know, when they're acquiring it, and so forth.
Well, we do know there are about 1.2 million people in the U.S. who are living with this disease. It stays pretty static as far as it's approximately 50,000 new cases that are diagnosed each year. It doesn't seem to go up much or down much from that number. It's about 50,000 who are living with this disease every year.
So in the state of
diagnosed with this disease every year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you, Terry. So in the state of Alaska, we're considered a low-incidence state, which means that we don't see a whole lot of transmission happening up here. Everybody who lives in Alaska knows that we are very unique geographically and the people that are up here. So we don't always follow lower 48 trends. So, for instance, up here, we're consistent with the lower 48 in that we see transmission predominantly among our MSMs, so men who are having sex with men. Last year in 2015, we saw almost an equal exchange between men who have sex with men and our heterosexual population. So, for instance, last year we saw 11 new cases that were first diagnosed in the state of Alaska among men having sex with men, and then we saw 9 transmissions through heterosexuals. So we're just very unique geographically.
How about the age of those heterosexuals? You know those off the top of your head? I mean, is it generally a younger population, or is it generally an older population?
Predominantly, it's among people who are under the age of 39 that
right.
we're catching. And right. back to something you said earlier about whether or not, how do we know that what we're doing is working?
Right.
Prevention is an interesting thing, because sometimes catching more cases means that you are doing your best in prevention. You're finding new ways and better ways to find folks and get them diagnosed and get them into treatment. And sometimes a lessening of numbers means that it's also working, so it's a tricky game.
Mm-hmm. Terry, how about the population you're involved in? Are you finding the same thing that Heather and Rebecca were saying? It's about 50-50 now, men who have sex with men that you're seeing it, and About 50% heterosexual?
Maybe not quite 50%, but close to that. So what we've seen has been, and I think this across the state, sort of a group of young men who have sex with men has been a high-risk group, and then the homeless population, and then just a smattering across the lifespan. So, you know, we are having new people diagnosed in their 50s or 60s, as well as their teens.
It seems so that the younger population, that group less than 30, and both the men who have sex with men and the heterosexual, seems to be one of the really important groups to be getting information and education out. And is that seems like that's a very big part of what we're talking about.
That is, and you know, in the across the country now, the biggest population is also the African American population, which is making up the biggest amount of new diagnoses right now. 40% of people living with HIV infection in 2011 were African Americans, and so the big push right now is in those hardest hit areas.
But I would say that's kind of regional. That
right
anywhere it seems to be the minority populations.
Yes. Mm.
Okay. And so, you know, in some areas it may be that the Hispanic population is at the highest risk. In Alaska, we have Alaska Native American Indians overrepresented, as well as African Americans. But across the country, African Americans are definitely the highest risk group.
Correct.
Let me remind everyone again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number again, 550-8433. 550-8433, toll free 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take our usual short one-minute break here, and then we'll continue our discussion of HIV and AIDS. And in particular, we're going to get into prevention of the spread from person to person is in a little bit more detail. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection, originating from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests are Rebecca Morrissey. She's the HIV Prevention Coordinator with Alaska AIDS Assistance Association, and Heather Davis, who is the Executive Director of the 4As. Also, then they're both in the studio with me, Terry Bramwell, who kind of runs the program for HIV/AIDS at an Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, is joining us by telephone. And we're discussing not only HIV and AIDS, but trying to focus, especially in the last half of the program, in prevention of person-to-person transmission. We do not have cures for these illnesses. We can prevent most of the lifelong disability and the potential for death with current treatments. But the focus now is really on trying to prevent the spread of this illness from individuals to individuals. And we're going to focus on that in the second half of the program. However, you're welcome to give questions and comments about any aspect of HIV and AIDS. And you can do that by calling us locally at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And please remember, you can always go to alaskapublic.org and click on the Line 1 archive link and listen to the program again, or refer someone that you'd like to have listen to the program later. The program does repeat tonight between 8 and 9 p.m., so if you're listening at that particular time, it's a rebroadcast, and we won't be able to answer questions. So what's the current big emphasis, then, on prevention that we've been wanting to talk about, and I've delayed getting into it?
So the current, the most recent tool in our tool bag is pre-exposure prophylaxis, also called PrEP. It's a medication, Truvada. Truvada is actually an HIV medication that is given to folks who are HIV positive. That in folks who are HIV positive is given in conjunction with other medications, so it's not the only medication that someone takes. But for folks who are HIV negative, it can reduce risk by 90% or more for individuals.
So pre-exposure prophylaxis, what does that mean exactly?
So it means that an individual is HIV negative and also at risk for becoming HIV positive. So it's prescribed for to individuals who are having sex with men who are having sex with other men, individuals who are injecting drugs, those high-risk heterosexuals that I talked about, so folks who are in a coupling, a serodiscordant couple where one person is HIV positive and one person is HIV negative. It's a medication that is taken one time once daily. It does require some medical surveillance as you're on the medication, and it's approved to be taken for about 5 years when someone's highest at risk in their life.
How do you take it?
It's an oral medication, one pill once daily.
And who takes it again? Who would decide that they need to take this?
So anybody who's having sex or is injecting drugs who would be at risk for contracting HIV.
Mm-hmm. So they may need to take it for extended periods of time. This is not something you take just before intercourse or anything.
No, it's a preventive medication. You can kind of think about it as birth control for HIV. So just like a woman would take a pill once daily to prevent pregnancy, it's a medication that gets started and reaches its peak efficacy. So when someone starts taking it, it's going to be effective at about 20 days, and then you continue to take it once daily after that.
What group of individuals are you all trying? Is the government, is the 4A's trying to market this ID to educate? What group of people are you working hard to get this information across to?
So for pre-exposure prophylaxis, for PrEP, I talk in counseling to anybody coming in for an HIV test who has some of those key risk factors involved. So it could be a young lady coming in who has multiple sex partners and rarely uses condoms, isn't great at using them effectively 100% every single time. Any of my injection drug users who come in through the exchange, we've talked and educated about PrEP. Mm-hmm. Most importantly, someone, like I said, has to be HIV negative in order to take the medication, as well as our young men having sex with men. It's, they're probably the most educated about PrEP, and oftentimes they'll come to us asking where to get it, how to get it.
How effective? To me, this seems like, I understand the idea. It just seems like getting someone to take medication, a young adult who's, I'm assuming, having exposures on a regular basis, they're taking this medication for a large percentage of the time.
Terry?
That is the challenge, is getting them to take it, especially younger people
right.
are not so good at taking a medication every day.
Right.
What we do know is if somebody isn't perfect at taking this medication, we know that if somebody is taking it every single day exactly as prescribed, that it's somewhere between 90 and 96% effective at preventing transmission. We know that if somebody takes it between 4 and 5 times per week, so they're pretty good about it, we know that it can give 70% or more effectiveness, and then it goes down from there the less that someone takes it.
Mm-hmm. How does it compare to other methods of preventing transmission?
So idealistically, somebody who is taking PrEP would also be using condoms. Condoms are somewhere between 96 and 90% effective at preventing transmission. On top of that, PrEP does not protect people from other STIs. So we're nationwide, we're number one for chlamydia in the state of Alaska. We have huge transmission here. We also rank pretty high for gonorrhea, so PrEP will not protect against those other STIs. Its main aim is to prevent a lifelong chronic illness, and it does that well.
Terry, any other comments? I'm sitting here thinking, well, gosh, condom's pretty cheap. You can use it just to need before exposure. I don't have to take it every day for weeks and weeks and weeks, not knowing when I might have a sexual encounter that's at risk. So what's the algorithm that goes on? Or Heather, you tell me what.
Well, you said condoms are cheap, and this isn't cheap, and there's still, you know, not easy ways to get this. It depends on if people have insurance, and you know, so it's not like a condom that you can just go pick up in the store or pull off a package from the counter. This is a prescribed medication, and I'm not sure what the cost is. Do you know what the cost is?
I'm not sure the cost. I think that the main takeaway about PrEP is that, even though condoms are cheap and they're readily available, people can get free condoms through our office. We can mail them to remote locations, but we're still seeing that people aren't using them. Transmission is still happening, and so we want to have just a multitude of different preventative tools at our hands.
Okay. All right. Terry, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I would say there are people that just choose not to use them, and so this is something that we can offer, but once again, if we can treat the people who have HIV, that is the most effective thing, and then PrEP is next. And people that are getting PrEP are also connected into the medical system because they need to come in every 3 months for screening labs and for other STIs as well as HIV, and that helps. That's just a time you can educate them.
Okay.
And encourage them to hopefully change their behaviors, but in the meantime.
Okay. We have a, I have an email and also have a phone call. I'm going to take the phone call. Mary, you're on line one.
Hello.
Yes. What can I do for you?
If you ask a prospective sex partner to take an HIV test, are they given a written certificate to prove they're HIV negative as opposed to taking their word for it?
Right, right. So how assured can you be of the response from your prospective sexual partner? Yep.
Okay, so when someone comes into the 4A's to receive a free HIV test, we educate folks about what is known as the window period. So, for example, if I were to have sex today, I could get tested today, but I would also want to get tested 3 months from now to ensure that I am, in fact, HIV negative. Our tests are about 99.7% accurate of what statuses are. An individual can receive a piece of paper if they'd like to that notes what their status was on that day, meaning reactive or non-reactive on the test. That's entirely up to that individual if they'd like to receive that piece of paper, and then it's entirely up to that individual if they choose to disclose that status to somebody else.
But that is only at one point in time, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's going forward from that day.
Right.
One thing I might note about the new HIV testing that we're doing, it can pick up infection as early as 2 weeks after somebody's been exposed or acquired the virus. So that's why we do repeated testing, so that we can catch people as early as possible. So we could test them in 2 or 3 weeks and then have them come back in 3 months to be sure.
Let's talk about that, because I'm not entirely sure I understand that. The way the immune system works is, let's say you're the first time you're exposed to a virus, let's say it's HIV, then your immune system has got to recognize it. It's got to gin up an immune response. It's got to, you know, your immune system has got to figure out, well, this is something for, and I got to make and tell cells in my body to begin to make up some immune response. So it often takes a couple of weeks to just get an immune response. So the 3 month time that you talked about, Rebecca, is probably at a time, and I'm just guessing now, that it's, we know for the 97% of people by that particular time are going to have an immune response. And so you're saying that we now have a test that's 2 weeks. Is that testing the immune system and it's just a little bit more sensitive, or is there some other way that that test is working?
It's actually newer technology where it tests for the antibody, which is what the old tests test for, but it also tests for a piece of the virus. It's called the P24 antigen. So it's one of the viral proteins, and that does peak somewhere between a week to a couple of weeks after infection. And so this newer test is called the fourth generation HIV-1 HIV-2 antigen antibody combo test, long name, but
right.
We just call it fourth generation test, test for both the viral particle and the antibody.
So, not to confuse listeners again, the antibody test most people are going, well, that we want to make sure people understand is there's definitely going to be a window period between exposure and the time the test can be done. And the accuracy of the testing does improve slightly with increasing amounts of time, although the new technologies is more sensitive in finding these antibodies and maybe parts of the viral DNA suggesting that you're infected. There is no, I'm going to say for sure, there's no 100% guaranteed positive time that you can, you know, for this, because there's nothing that's 100% in medicine. And we see false positives and false negatives. So we want people to be aware of that too. Anything else that needs to be said about that?
Well, one thing that was important about this new technology and being able to pick up infection as early as 2 to 3 weeks after is that is when most people are going to have symptoms of acute HIV infection, flu-like symptoms, mono-like symptoms that might actually drive them to a healthcare provider. Ah. And in the past, if we tested them for HIV, they would have been most likely negative, and we would have missed that opportunity to get them into care. So now when somebody presents with acute HIV, we actually have a tool to identify them and get them into care immediately.
So I if I'm hearing you right, and I'm thinking about the public listening to this, is it does take a while for the antibodies, the immune response, to develop. But the titer of that virus may be at a level early when you're having symptoms that it may be detectable with sophisticated some testing now. But then that level of virus may slowly decrease over time so that, again, later the antibody test might still be a very effective way to do this.
Right. So if there hasn't been an exposure in the last 3 months,
right,
it doesn't really confer an advantage.
Okay.
The old antibody test or the older technology is still perfectly good.
Okey-doke.
It's really just key in that early period, the first month or so of infection.
All right. Thanks for your call. What else? There's an email that was sent in that said, how effective is circumcision? We are at a point in, at least my experience as a pediatrician who does circumcisions, where circumcisions were decreasing in the population. And then the American Academy of Pediatrics and several recommending organizations seem to be backing off the idea that we shouldn't be doing them, and now they're kind of quasi leave it up to the families to make a decision. And part of the reason for that change is this issue of circumcision being protective against not only HIV, but certainly sexually transmitted illnesses and so forth. Who wants to tackle this one? How effective is circumcision?
Well, it's quite effective in areas like in Africa where there's areas of very high prevalence of HIV. It has definitely been shown to help prevent the male from acquiring HIV.
Mm-hmm.
In low prevalence areas, it doesn't offer as much effect on prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in the U.S., for instance, we're
not
pushing circumcision like you might in a very high prevalence area.
As a reason to prevent HIV infection.
Right.
So how safe is this PrEP? We take a medication. If we're a high-risk individual, we're taking it daily. How safe is it?
It's really pretty safe. One of the monitoring tests we do, we test, generally this is how I would do it, test every 3 months for HIV. We also test at least every 6 months for renal function, because the medication is known in HIV-positive people on long-term treatment to cause some renal disease and bone loss. That hasn't been seen in PrEP, but then people are not on this for 10, 15, 20 years either, generally. So with the monitoring, it's really quite safe. A very few people have some side effects from it, like nausea and diarrhea. Most people do not have side effects.
and individuals who are taking PrEP still need to keep up other efforts to prevent transmission of both HIV and other sexually transmitted illnesses.
That's correct. And one thing we have seen is because they have to come in every 3 months to renew their prescription and get their screening labs, that we're picking up STDs that may have gone undetected, mm-hmm. such as syphilis or other STDs.
So
we can treat those right away.
Can you take PrEP after you've had an exposure?
So if you've had an exposure, you would not take PrEP. You would take something called post-exposure prophylaxis. And that's a grouping, again, of HIV medications that is taken for 28 days. And it's been shown to prevent HIV about 96% of the time.
All right. So this is different.
This is different. This is after you have had a possible or known exposure to HIV. Mm-hmm. Truvada is a one-swoop medication. It's only one medication that's given for HIV. PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis, is a grouping of medications, so it's better equipped to prevent HIV from taking hold if somebody has been exposed.
And one of the key points about post-exposure prophylaxis is it really needs to be started as soon as possible, preferably within 4 hours. And after the efficacy declines over time, and after 72 hours, it's not felt to really be efficacious at all.
All right, so it's the same medication as used for pre-exposure prophylaxis, but now we're talking about after exposure. Is that true, or am I misunderstanding?
It's more medications.
All right. So it's some of the same medications plus others.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same usually the same medication plus another potent medication.
All right, so this seems to me, just off the top of my head, to be a much more important bit of information. I think both informations are important, but now we've got individuals who may have had unprotected sex, may have had high-risk sex, and they've got a limited amount of time to do something about this. And that can prevent infection in a very high percentage of the cases?
Yes, and also if somebody has a needle stick, this is
same thing.
It's occupational. So if somebody had a needle stick from an HIV-positive person, then they could elect to take this, as well as somebody who, you know, maybe the condom broke and they had a known HIV-positive partner or another high-risk situation. It's also given in the case of sexual assault if somebody wants it.
Let me remind listeners once more, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. We're talking about HIV and AIDS, and particularly some new information about how you can protect yourself if you've had unprotected or high-risk sex for transmission of HIV. If you would like, you can also email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. We'll be able to answer your phone calls for about another 10 minutes. Again, the local number, 550-8433, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. How available is this prevention then? If you've got a limited amount of time, this is like post pregnancy prophylaxis, you know, trying to do something with the morning after pill. So are people provided with this treatment to have on their person, or do they have to come seek some help once they've had the exposure?
Usually it's accessed through the emergency room or urgent care or possibly a primary care provider, but generally, it's accessed through the emergency room.
Okay.
This is very time sensitive.
And how about safety of this treatment compared to PrEP, which we said was really fairly safe, it sounds like?
It's really generally safe. It's only taken for 28 days, so there's not really risk of long-term side effects. And somebody would be followed by a healthcare provider to just monitor.
How about cost? Cost is a huge barrier, in my experience, in healthcare, increasingly a problem.
So when we're talking about pre-exposure prophylaxis, there are a number of ways that somebody can acquire this medication and then go on to get assistance in paying for it. Most insurance companies, private insurance, will cover the cost of this medication. A secondary route is Gilead are the folks who produce this medication. And on their website, they do have a medication assistance program that can help offset the cost of the medication and the prescription, whether or not the person has insurance. And I'll let Terry cover the PEP.
Medicaid will also cover it, and I think that speaks to how effective it's considering if insurance companies will cover it. They know very well that even though it's expensive, it's far less expensive than treating somebody who acquires HIV for the long run, so it's worth it. And we've not had trouble really getting insurance companies to cover it in general.
And the medications are easily available at pharmacies?
Yes, maybe not every small mom-and-pop pharmacy, but they can be ordered fairly quickly.
How do you all feel that to me, this is really an important advance, the PEP in particular, the PrEP, I think there's some difficulties with getting people to use the medications long-term and balancing that with the risk of condoms and other things. But this is different. This is something where you've had an exposure and you really have a limited amount of time. How well do you think this information is available to the public, and particularly those at risk?
I would say that individuals who come into 4A's to get tested who are terrified because they believe they may have been exposed, more often than not, these folks are already out of that 72-hour window to be able to take PEP. Right. So I would say there's overall a general lack of knowledge about post-exposure post-exposure prophylaxis within our community.
Mm-hmm. So someone comes in, they're after the 72 hours. What's the advice then?
So the advice then is to continue to get tested, figuring out where they are in their window period, when to come back for a test. Education surrounding what symptoms to look for, when to seek a greater level of medical care if they are experiencing symptoms, what they can do to reduce their risk of either contracting or spreading if they do have a possible infection when they leave. And just encouraging that this is, while it is a life-altering and life-changing illness, it's no longer, it doesn't have to be a life-threatening or a life-ending one.
Terry, I'm going to ask you this because I'm thinking you might have the best perspective on this, although Heather, Rebecca, please don't hesitate to join. For you guys who are doing this every day, you know what to tell people when they walk in the door and so forth. I'm suspicious that the general practicing private sector and public even sector, I'm thinking Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center and Wells private, the private physicians like myself, are not as up to date on this this ability to treat within the first 72 hours to prevent infection. Do you think there is a good enough understanding in the primary sector, public sector, outside of the sector that's dealing with these individuals to a large degree almost on a daily basis?
Well, I think neighborhood health does have a high level of knowledge, and anybody working in an emergency room or urgent care should as well. They usually have right. protocols in place if somebody presents.
Good.
But in terms of the public perception, I don't know so much that they're aware. It's always surprising to me how many myths people still believe and how little they really know about current methods of treatment.
We're in a really interesting time, I think, in the HIV epidemic, in which there's so many treatment options available now, and folks who are integrated into care and are consistent with care can live long, happy, healthy lives with lots of support. But on the other hand of that, the CDC looks at HIV infection now as a long-term chronic illness that is fully capable of being put into primary care and having primary care physicians following these folks throughout their lifespan. At the same time, there's an incredible amount of stigma surrounding HIV infection and what that means for individuals, and can often be a barrier for people getting tested and knowing their status, which is why, you know, we have specialists that still work with folks who are HIV positive.
And I think, you know, the other recommendation by the CDC is that, you know, all physicians should be offering their patients an HIV test when they come in for their annual physical. Have you had an HIV test? You know, have you been tested? And we hear over and over again that their doctors never ask them that
right.
question ever.
Right.
And not only don't ask them, they often tell them they don't need them because they're
right.
not at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so we, you know, that is a frustration for us in both the state of Alaska, their prevention program, and our AIDS education and training program really do make a lot of effort to try and train providers on these topics, but it's still an uphill battle. It's not big news. HIV is not big mm-hmm. news these days unless we have a big outbreak, and then the horse is out of the barn.
We've got just a couple of minutes left. Should we say something about home tests? I haven't heard much about that. Are they effective? What's the worry? What are the problems people should recognize about them?
So I do know that the OraSure test, which is an oral swab, there's also a finger stick that you can get at Walgreens. You can buy it off the shelf. It gets sent off in the mail, and then you get called and notified of results. It's still a reportable bloodborne illness, and so you still have to make contact. So nothing is ever completely anonymous. It's considered confidential, so that information is protected.
And that information would be well after the 72-hour period of time where you could have prevented potential infection.
Yes, and then you don't have the benefit of someone being face-to-face with you who's going to be educating you about that window period, about your individual risk factors. And so I think face-to-face is always ideal.
The home test kits, they are expensive, so that's really a limiting factor. They're around $40 to $50. But when you do, they do come with very good instructions and counseling. And when you call for your test results, I believe they give you counseling as well.
Heather, I'm going to leave the last minute to you. What do we want individuals to hear and remember from this program today?
We want people to get tested. We want people to know their HIV status. If they've never had a test, no matter what your age, you know, I think we focus a lot on the younger people, but, you know, like we said, we have older heterosexuals also, or older people who also need to be tested. It's all ages 13 to 64. So, you know, it's National HIV Testing Day, and that's what this is all about, okay. for everybody to get tested.
They have been tested because they've been in multiple times for routine medical screenings for cholesterol, diabetes, et cetera. This should really be incorporated, but it has not been embraced widely, I'd say, by the medical community.
And just remembering that National HIV Testing Day is June 27th. That's 1 week from today. 4A's, which is located on 1057 West Fireweed, Suite 102. We will be opening our doors at 7:30 a.m. so that folks can come by before work to get tested. The test takes about 15 minutes to get results.
All right. This has been another quick hour. A lot of information. I've learned some stuff today. I'm getting behind in my AIDS understanding, so I appreciate it. Hope everyone else does, too. My thanks to our guest, Rebecca Morrissey, HIV Prevention Coordinator with 4A's of Alaska, and Heather Davis, the Executive Director. Terry Bramble joined us by telephone. She is the Program Director at an Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. If you want to continue the discussion on HIV and person-to-person transmission, you can join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org. Line one will probably take a little break next week, and there'll be a rebroadcast of a prior program. We're working on trying to get a new program, but I don't think we're going to make it. Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line
Have a great
One is
day.
A production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.